Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got Ellen Brown back today. We'll talk financial issues. That's always very big, and I always say it that Ellen does some of the most terrific financial writing I know. And her book, Web of Debt, it's so overwhelming when I read it. Anybody who hasn't read Web of Debt, I've got the first edition. Ellen has an updated, newer edition. Anybody who hasn't read it is really cheating themselves. Oh, it's a steal. It's such a treasure trove of vital information about all the problems. The main problems in the country stem from financial problems. You know, money, power in the hands of crooks that take full advantage. And Ellen not only lays it out plainly, she covers the history of what's worked in the past, and she explains very clearly what will work now if we can only get people in positions of power to do it. But of course we haven't, unless ordinary people do something about it, get mad enough to act in their own behalf, their own welfare, to produce change. Before we get into that, I do want to say something about one other very important thing. It was on my mind. I thought about it yesterday, but I saved it for today because today is day one of a historic 16th non-alignment movement summit. What is the non-alignment movement? It's an organization. I've seen different numbers of member countries. I've seen 118. I've seen 120. Let's round it off and call it 120 countries of the world belonging to the non-alignment movement. It began in 1961. Famous figures were at that world summit. Oh, later ones, I think Castro was there. In 1979, he gave a Havana Declaration. An absolute marvelous statement on what should really be laid out as the sovereign rights of all nations, all people, the kind of things that, you know, people talk about nominally, but they don't do. And in most cases, they don't exist. Even in democracies like America, dare I say, these things are talked about. It's all rhetoric. It's not reality. It's getting worse all the time. Boy, I could go on that topic alone. But anyway, today is day one in Tehran. Very important summit. Tehran will also inherit the presidency of the movement, NAM, for the next 3 years. Possibly it could be extended longer than that. The next summit, if it isn't 3 years or 4 years, whenever, will be in Venezuela. Chavez looks like a sure thing in October in his reelection bid. He's got almost a 2-to-1 lead over his opponent with a little over 2 months to go. Pretty tough lead to overcome. And Venezuelans be crazy to vote for the other guy. Absolute. Unless they decided to commit mass suicide, they'd never support the other guy. He's a corporate thug. The worst kind. The kind that the Venezuelans got rid of in 1999. You think they want to go back to that? Anyway, Venezuela will take over the presidency of NAM in, let's call it, 2015, if things go as it looks like they will now. And if Chavez is reelected and he stays healthy, then he'll be the president. Oh, that's wonderful. Back-to-back anti-imperial countries. Doesn't that sound marvelous? Well, NAM is important because next to the UN, it's the most significant world body. The UN has 193 nations. NAM, let's call it 120. Big nations. They also have observers. I think about 20, forget the number exactly, let's call it around 20 observer countries. They include Russia and China. Both of them will be represented at the summit. And impressive people coming. Heads of state, presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers, other ministers, vice presidents, key people showing up in Tehran. I don't think Tehran has ever seen anything like this before. I am certain that most countries have never seen anything like this before. To my knowledge, America has never seen anything like this. Well, you know, America gets the UN General Assembly in every September, so I take that back. But that's kind of a pro forma thing. This is a once every few year event. It's very major, and it's the specific topics that are discussed. At the UN General Assembly, either heads of state show up, or if they can't come, they send representatives could be a prime minister, could be, well, a president might send a prime minister, or a prime minister may send a president if the prime minister is top dog, or maybe a vice president will come. One year, Chavez, for some reason, couldn't go. He sent his foreign minister to represent him. Every country can speak on whatever issue it wishes to address. So it's a talking shop. Whatever is on the mind of a given country, it can give a speech, and it can express its views. It can be short. It can go on forever. And that's what the General Assembly is. NAM has a very specific agenda. Important things. Individual rights, national sovereignty, economic development. I think above all, peace. Peace and solidarity for issues benefiting all member countries. Now, what's more important than that? I think people are coming to get together and consider these issues very carefully. I'm sure they will. There was a huge document prepared in advance. I believe it's 688 pages. Multiple documents within it. Important things that will be discussed over 6 days. I wish I could be there. My goodness, that would be a wonderful event to attend. Lots of journalists are there. Had to be arranged, I'm sure, well in advance. And I think Tehran is decked out in its finest to welcome everybody. Even two countries that are not exactly on good relations with Iran are coming. Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah is sending his son. My goodness. Oh, my God. And the other country is Bahrain. Until the 12th of August, neither country had diplomatic relations with the other one. Iran still refuses to have diplomatic relations with Bahrain until it stops murdering and torturing its people. Well, I agree. I don't know why anybody would want to have relations with Bahrain, or Saudi Arabia for that matter, or America for that matter. I could go on and on. 30 minutes after my program, I'll get a chance to discuss this on Iran's Press TV. I was delighted when they called me to do it. So we'll get on to finance and so on. And after my program is over, I can think more about NAM. Anyway, I wrote an article about it this morning. It was my second one. Maybe Press TV will even post it. It'll be on my blog site tomorrow. I'm very impressed with this, and I support it 100%. Anyway, Ellen Brown, Web of Debt. Ellen, welcome. I didn't expect to go on. Nine minutes I went on. My goodness. That's a long soliloquy. One of my marvelous guests, John McMurtry, he likes me to begin every program with a few comments of my own. He suggested it, and I'd love to do it. I mean, I could spend the whole program commenting, but the program is for me to play host and for marvelous guests like you to be the guest, and I welcome you, Ellen.
Thanks, Stephen. I will say about Syria, I was just reading, Syria is just like Libya. It has its own bank, issues its own money. It supports interest-free banking. It has complete medical coverage, pays for education through the higher education. So it's got all the same, it's got the same sort of financial setup that Libya had, so you could argue.
You could understand why both countries were targeted, Ellen.
Yeah.
When you're talking about Libya, you're talking about the former Libya, not the present Libya.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The former Libya was a social state. Gaddafi didn't like democracy because democracies usually don't turn out well. And I must say, I agreed with him. Absolutely don't. Well, look at America. That's Exhibit A. America never had democracy. It always talked democracy, Ellen, but it never had it, going back to the beginning. My God, I mean, women had no power. Black people were property, not people. You know, women were only supposed to be childbearers and homemakers. So they didn't have voting rights, sovereignty, until the 20th century. Abe Lincoln didn't give them sovereign rights. Can you imagine that? And we call this a democracy? Of course, they murdered the original people who lived here. I mean, they slaughtered them, they displaced them, they starved them, they gave them diseases. What kind of democracy does stuff like that? Is this what ancient Greece talked about, Ellen?
Yeah, well, I agree. And even in a good democracy, it How do you get everybody together?
Yeah,
I mean, it does seem like you'd be better off with a group of people who know what they're doing, and they get appointed or, you know, get up there because they know what they're doing. And then, well, it is an issue. How do you elect the leader if it's not democratic? But anyway, I totally agree.
I think the first thing you do is you get money out of elections, and you publicly fund them and give everybody a level playing field. Anybody who's a legitimate candidate who, say, gets a certain percentage of people supporting them, 5% or something, I mean, something reasonable, not the way the system is rigged today with one party and two wings. I mean, it literally doesn't matter. I mean, you've got the Republicrats and the Democrats, whatever you want to call them.
So it's still a democracy, right? I mean, you're still talking about everybody voting. So
well,
what are the alternatives?
I'm not so sure about everybody voting, Yellen. You know, we have corporate-run, programmed electronic voting machines. So, you know, you put your vote in for candidate A, and candidate B gets two votes.
Yeah. Well, but still, looking at democracy versus the alternative, what is the alternative?
Well, I agree. I like the notion of direct democracy. And, I mean, people literally having more say. And one way to do that is by referenda. When Chavez was elected, he asked the Venezuelan people by referenda, would you like a new constitution drafted? He let them decide. And they overwhelmingly said yes. And then a constitution was drafted. It was put to a second referendum, and the people actually got to decide, do you want this thing or don't you want it? Mm-hmm. Well, the people value it so much, and it's a huge constitution, 350-odd articles in it. I've looked through it. I didn't want to read it all, but I looked through and I've quoted passages from it. But people have some kind of a tiny pocket-sized version of this thing, and they carry it around with them. Can you imagine Americans carrying around the U.S. Constitution?
No, but that's the thing. You need a pretty enlightened votership in order to have everybody vote on issues, because otherwise it's so easy to mislead people.
It sure is.
I mean, there certainly have been a lot of initiatives here that weren't good ideas that the people passed because they didn't really know what they were passing. In fact, I always feel overwhelmed when I see those, just the propositions, because you just don't believe them. Like, I do not believe that's what you're really up to. You're really trying to do something else, and you haven't told us about it. So at least if you're a professional politician, you spend all day getting steeped in the issues, and you have an idea what's being talked about. I don't know. It's difficult. I mean, I personally would vote for the Egyptian enlightened philosopher queen. But it's just you can't find those things where they're hard to come by. I mean, you got to find somebody with the third eye opened, you know, and the little snake coming out of it. But you just don't find that.
Well, I would say based on the kind of democracy America has gotten for so many eons, I will take virtually anything that calls itself a democracy other than the above. I mean, the system is so broken and dysfunctional and corrupted. I mean, money power runs the country. We know that. You write about it all the time. I mean, you know, the stranglehold that money power, you can call it Wall Street, you can call it money power, call it anything you want. I like the phrase of money power in private hands. I mean, they take full advantage, and they have the country by the throat to get anything it wants. And unless we find a way to change this system, then nothing else will change.
Yeah, that's why we're working that's why we're working at the grassroots level, the local level, because it seems to me that's where you're more likely to be able to get things done. I mean, it's still difficult. Like, we're trying to get, we've got 18 states that have introduced bills for public banks, but it's just very difficult to get them passed because you've still got a great big bureaucracy or a great big machine. You've got to move your way.
You get corrupt governors like yours who, even if there's a smidgen of interest in the legislature, a Jerry Brown, a Democrat says, to hell with this law. I'm not going to pass it. I'm going to veto it. Don't you dare pass this law and send it to me. Well, you know, I mean, he's probably pocketing big bribes from the bankers in the state, and the original home state of Bank of America back in the old days when it was just Bank of America. No,
I think it should be Bank of America. I think they should nationalize it. I mean, I think that would actually work to take those five big banks that are really bankrupt, that the government is, that would have failed if the government hadn't bailed them out, and make them government banks. Then you would have, you know, a great big institution that would be actually would be banking in the public interest. It would be, credit as a public utility, just like water and power and roads and, all the things that connect people and that people share, it seems to me, are appropriately public utilities.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. You could even rename it and call it the real Bank of America or the People's Bank of America.
Uh-huh.
I mean, something that literally would serve all the people in the country instead of the one-tenth of 1%. The 1% metaphor is nice, but it's really the one-tenth of 1%. Those are the people that have all the money and the power, and they control everything, and and the bankers sit at the top of the totem pole. And the bankers, I like to think of the war profiteers also, Ellen. The bankers are war profiteers. Bankers profit on everything that goes on business-wise, and war very much. War is a business. It's a business. If there wasn't money to be made out of it, they wouldn't be fought. What would be the point?
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, it's the only business that we allow the government to go into these days, and so it's a huge business.
But that's even being privatized with all the private contractors, Ellen.
True.
There were more private contractors in Iraq by a long shot than U.S. troops, down to 50,000 or so. The Pentagon did not evacuate Iraq. It just repositioned troops in surrounding countries and so on. Still 50,000 of them there. And every U.S. service member is called a combat troop. You know, you could be the kitchen cook or a bottle washer. Everybody is trained to be a combatant if they're called on to do it. They know how to fire the weapons. They're trained in them. I mean, when I went through training back in the 1950s, they taught me to fire stuff I never laid a hand on afterwards. I don't think I ever picked up a pistol, but I fired rifles. I fired machine guns, the kind that they could literally saw you in half, even in those days. And I threw hand grenades. It scares me to even think about it now.
I can't really envision it.
This was down in Texas, Ellen. But they're all trained, and in Afghanistan, there were more private contractors in Afghanistan the last time I checked. It's been a while since I've written about it, but over a year ago, more private contractors, you know, the Blackwater types, than U.S. forces, and there are over 100,000 U.S. forces there. I mean, it's astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
The whole system is just so rotten and broken and corrupted, and the only thing America is skilled at is stealing other people's wealth and going around destroying things, destroying people, destroying nations. And
writing on right now is, I keep saying I've got this book almost done, but I'm really so close to done, but on public banking globally. And the other half of the world, like 40% of the world, is the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And they are dominated by a public, their banking sector is dominated by public banks, which means instead of having private banks create the money, the government creates the money, basically. And the government does with it what is good for the populace and for the economy. And they're obviously doing much better. So there is a much better model out there. But A, we've never heard of it. And B, we have all this prejudice against socialism. And there are all these barriers to break through. And so that's why I'm writing about it. And then my last two articles that I wrote since the last time we talked are, you know, about solutions. One is a solution at the county level, and one is a solution at the federal level, which would be the postal bank idea.
Oh,
so anyway, there are things that can be done. We got to start at the bottom instead of the top and kind of just chip our way into it.
Well, you made an important statement a little bit earlier about we have to address these things at the grassroots, and to me that's a fundamental point. There's no possibility that we'll get any change from the top down, you know, getting the politicians to change their ways. You know, it's like trying to get an old fogey like me to suddenly completely change my lifestyle. I mean, at age 78, I mean, I'm happy to make some changes, but you want me to turn from red into pink or something? I mean, it's a little late in my life to
that's
do something like that.
Go, right,
but I'm always eager to tweak my body and my mindset to do things better than I'm doing now. But I don't want to turn myself upside down. But there's only one way that you ever get changed. I think in the history of the world, the only time change ever came is when people on their own worked hard enough, long enough, and they made it happen. It won't happen any other way. And people a lot smarter than me have said that. I've quoted a few of them. And it can be done. I mean, it literally can be done. It's not easy, and it's not quick. But some amazing things happen in America. And once I had somebody on another program I hosted who wrote a book about this, about the marvelous things that happened in America in the past. And the book was terrific, and I quoted it a number of times. Author was Francis Fox Bevan on... I forget the precise title. It's been so long now, 4 or 5 years ago. But I mean, extraordinary things like ending slavery. I mean, you go back far enough, and if you talk to people about ending slavery, they would have thought that's impossible, even people in the North. But it happened. You know, it happened. It could happen in roundabout ways, but it happened. I mean, labor rights, civil rights.
Well, you would have thought that what happened in 2008 was impossible until it happened.
That's right.
You would have thought of nationalizing all, you know, Fannie and Freddie and different things that they did, the bailouts.
Well, having grown up in a different world than we live in today, Ellen, what happened in 2008, the economic and financial distress that happened, that seemed like an impossibility to me. I mean, you know, I mean, we should have learned something from the Great Depression. I went through my entire life when we had recessions, even a couple that were very nasty ones, 1973, 74, 1980, 81, or 82, mean and nasty recessions. but we got through them a couple of years or so. Excuse me. And things came back just fine. I mentioned yesterday on the program, had economist Jack Rasmus on, Ellen. I mentioned that people need to remember that we're 5 years into this crisis. It broke in fall of 2007. 5 years into this crisis, not only is it not resolved, it's worse, I think, than it was then, because poverty is much higher in America. Human need is much higher. Homelessness and hunger are much higher. There are provisions that are being stripped away, so instead of helping people, we've had this horrible austerity that's gone on all these years, and there's a fiscal cliff hit coming at the on January 1. How they're going to handle that, I'm not sure. I'm sure they'll extend the Bush administration tax cuts. They're not going to hammer the rich folks. They're going to be sure they get what they want. I think they can make them give up a little something here, a little something there, but the big stuff they're going to keep. They're not going to touch that, and it's possible that the big changes they want to hammer domestic spending with. Jack Rasmus yesterday said he thinks they'll be backloaded. The big things are hammering Medicare, Medicaid, and sooner or later Social Security. So they'll backload them maybe. Maybe they'll do some up front, and they'll do the heavy lifting, backloading, and they can always postpone it again if they want to. Instead of 2013, they can make it 2014. If things are worse then than 2013, they may well be, make it 2015. But, I mean, they literally want to...
It's also unnecessary. You could fix the whole thing by just realizing that it's our money. Just print the money and pay for Social Security, pay for Medicare as you go. You don't need to save 75 years ahead. You don't need to invest the money and live off the 2% you earn from these trillions of dollars you have invested. Just spend the money as you go. And then most of that money is going to stimulate the economy. It's going to go into producing more goods and services. Supply will go up with demand, and it will not create inflation. But when you see that the prices are rising across the board, that's when you pull it back in with taxes. And you do the taxes not to pay for the expenditures, but to keep the money supply stable. In other words, you pull enough back in to where prices are stable again. And it's just that we have this total misconception about debt, where everybody's panicked about this $15 trillion debt. Well, the $15 trillion debt is our money supply because all of our money comes from debt. If the government were not $15 trillion in debt, we would have no money to spend. So we shouldn't be happy about that when, you know, when they spend money. It's just like when your employer gives you money. Let's say that it was all a zero-sum game, and so your employer would borrow the money to pay you. Now you've got some money to spend, and then you can buy his products, and, it, you know, it'll go back the other way. Well, that's another thing. They really should let the government do some business. Instead, they wouldn't have to tax us if they would actually let the government make some money. Like, for example, a post office bank where they could actually get paid interest, or, you know, all the energy things, it seems to me, should be publicly owned, and then fees would go back to the government, and then all the things they've given away, like they invented the internet, and if you were just charging pennies, you know, for usage per month or something, you'd have a huge amount of money.
Well, I agree. I absolutely agree. And the other thing that galls me is I agree with you on the debt. What bothers me about the debt, Ellen, I'm sure you too, is that we run it up to give banks and other big financial interests the ability to speculate, not use for economic development and growth. And as far as government resources go largely to the rich, to waging imperial wars, to handing to, in the form of subsidies to corporations that go back many, many, many years, and the bailing out banks when they get in trouble. The big national put, Ellen, you know, do anything reckless you want to do, get in trouble, get on the verge of bankruptcy, don't worry about it. Whatever you need to keep you going, you know, we'll just print it up for you. Deliver it this afternoon. On second thought, we'll deliver it in 2 seconds. Here it is. If it's not enough, let us know. We'll double it. I mean, what kind of a system is that? And then we claim, Washington, Obama, and the others claim that we're broke, the country is broke, and we can't do these other things, so ordinary people have to be hammered, and that's the scheme. But the nation's resources are being used for things hurting people, not helping them, and benefiting investments.
And that's not true in China, Japan, India, Brazil, all those places that they went through desperate times. And so they didn't have time to mess around with, you know, rich people siphoning money off the top. Like India, before India became independent, they had a huge famine and it killed millions of people. So what are you going to do in that situation? You have to just get down to business and take care of your people. So government needs to be directed toward the people. You need you need a state that you need to take care of people. My son's here now, and we are watching Bleak House. You know, it's a series British series, TV series, and it's so bleak. I mean, the way conditions were in the 1850s, before you had any kind of social safety net, that's what we're going to go back to again. If they're going to cut us off from the thing is, it's all hidden now, so you don't really see the bleakness. You don't see the people starving in the streets. You don't see. You're not allowed to sleep in the park with a blanket over. You have to. You're not even actually supposed to sleep in your car, but that's what people do if they've got a car. Those are the upper class homeless have a car. And then the poverty is in, it's bread lines. I mean, the bread lines are in food stamps, so you don't really see those people lined up at midnight waiting for their food stamp cards to kick in.
Oh, indeed. And on frigid cold days in Chicago in the wintertime, Ellen, in a good part of town, you see people crouched in doorways, sleeping on streets, sleeping
that's
wherever they can find it.
Unbelievable in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it can be mean and nasty. You don't even want to be out. You want to be in, and these people are living out there. Anyway, let's take a break, and we'll be right back. On with Ellen Brown. Well, we're having a great discussion, Ellen. Sometimes I'm never certain where the conversation will go, but this one is lovely. We're really ranging over a number of things and discussing the importance of ordinary people and the fact that government should serve everyone and the kind of system we have and the one that we should have but don't have. And I must say, I think my regular listeners know that I'm a product of the Wharton School, and I never thought of myself as a socialist, but, you know, when you think about hard facts and what helps people, what hurts people, you know, most people, you, Ellen, and me, we pay. I mean, I'm no longer working, but I've got my IRA that, sadly, I have to draw on every year. I wish I didn't have to. It's mandatory once you reach a certain age. So I get that, and I have to pay taxes. And my feeling is that my taxes shouldn't go to bankers. They shouldn't go to killing people overseas. The taxes we pay ought to be producing services right here at home. They should grow the country to lift all boats. They should help ordinary people. And instead, my taxes are going to do all the destructive things, all the things that harm me, not help me. And I'm not in dire need the way growing numbers in America are, millions and millions of people, where I quoted from an article that goes back a number of months now, where the New York Times actually reported this, very surprising, that new census data, they were doing something to tweak their out-of-date definition of poverty, family of four, $22,500 or so. My God, I mean, a family of four in Chicago would starve to death in that amount of money. I'm not certain they could do anything more than pay their rent if they were lucky, and maybe take care of a few essentials, maybe buy food, and that's about it. I couldn't afford health care, couldn't afford anything. So, I mean, you really need more than that. A poverty level ought to be at least double that figure. And, of course, it varies depending on whether you live on the farm or you live in Chicago or New York or L.A., Ellen. Big, big, big difference. But there's no distinction from one place to another. So the whole system is out of whack. And the same formula has been used for decades. Anyway, I think they were tweaking it a little bit. And the New York Times said that, according to Census Bureau new data, half the households in the country are either impoverished or bordering on it. Well, to me, that means half of them are living in poverty. Half the people in America, in the richest country in the world, living in poverty? Now, is that a definition of a failed system or what?
It is, and the fact that we allow this whole growth of a very wealthy class is so out of balance. I mean, there's obviously just something wrong with our system. Why can they do that? It's because of exponential growth. You don't find exponential growth in nature, but interest is allowed to grow exponentially, and it's allowed to, not just interest, but profits, you know, grow exponentially, and they suck the money out of the real economy. But anyway, I would like to talk on the latest events of the last week that I just wrote about, which is in Washington State, there was a sort of landmark ruling that MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, was not a beneficiary under a deed of trust for purposes of foreclosing in a non-judicial foreclosure, which Washington, like California, is a non-judicial foreclosure state. So MERS, most of these properties that people have lost are in the name of MERS. You know, it's this electronic database that they've concealed the whole securitization of the housing market behind. But in doing that, they've destroyed the property records everywhere. You can't really prove title anymore. It's not really clear who owns these properties. You have a lot of, you know, it's investors, but you don't know which set of investors. You have a lot of cases where somebody's totally paid off their home and then somebody else comes and tries to foreclose because they seem to think they have an interest in some other piece of it. Apparently it goes back to, I heard that Bear Stearns, for example, would take a single piece of real estate and use it as the collateral for all these various investor groups, where they would take the money and then they would pay off the groups by the month, you know, with the money from one set of investors, and then all the rest of the money that they got, they would invest it themselves in these speculative ventures. So it's just that they've totally destroyed what used to be the foundation of life. You know, what you had was your property, and you could identify your little piece of property, and you could prove it in the records that this was yours going back for generations. You know, you could prove, you could show the chain all the way back to whenever, the beginning of the country or something. That's the way it was supposed to be. So that's all being destroyed. So the counties need to do something about it. They're motivated to do something about it. They've got all these, well, City of San Bernardino is now bankrupt. And so the County of San Bernardino is looking at these proposals to take properties by eminent domain, only if you want them to. You know, if you've got a mortgage that's double what your house is now worth, and you're paying this exorbitant amount, but you want to keep your house, you would have the option of going to this agency that would be set up, and they would take the property by eminent, or they would take the mortgage by eminent domain. So they're only taking the piece of paper, you know, the contract that you signed for this home, and then they would renegotiate the whole deal at fair market value. So the proposals that are out there, there's a middleman, private business, you know, and they obviously expect to make a nice fee out of this. In fact, they're the ones that are going to make money no matter what, because they just get a certain percentage, and the county could well be left holding the bag, and that's what everybody's worried about. So what I just wrote about was the possibility, you know, with this ruling in Washington State, that the county could go in by eminent domain and take those properties free and clear. They don't have to. They don't need a middleman, and they don't need, you know, they don't need to be negotiating with the bank, because the bank has no title, no claim. I mean, what you do under eminent domain is you would post this in the paper that we, the county, are planning to take these properties because it's in the best interest of the public. You know, the whatever blighted, foreclosed, and the underwater ones that are about to go into foreclosure. And anybody who can prove title will pay fair market value. But that puts the burden on the bank, or you know, MERS, it's now in the name of MERS, to prove who's got title. So they're going to have to show their hand at the very least, and show which set of investors now has the mortgage. But which nobody does. That's the thing. It's all been kind of obscured behind this whole smoke screen. So anyway, the county might, I'm arguing, could get these properties free and clear. Then they could put them in their own bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota, you know, which would be a sort of a mini Fed for the area. In other words, it would be a bank that would take the revenues of the county, because it would be the county's own bank, and then it would double the money, essentially, by lending out the very same money that was still there on deposit. It's not that the county would be lending its money. The bank would be lending money in the same way that Bank of America takes your money and then makes loans. So your money, the county's money, would still be there, but at the same time, the bank would be enabled by all these deposits and capital that they would get from the county to do what all chartered banks do, which is lend their deposits effectively, you know, lend a sum equal to their deposits, supposedly. In fact, they can lend double their deposits, because they borrow from other banks or borrow from the money markets. Anyway, they can do what banks do. So we could have all the perks of a bank getting the money very cheaply at 0.25% and then lending it out at 5%, or even buying our own bonds, or, you know, buying the infrastructure bonds at 5%. And or 4%, I think they're probably 4% now, but only paying 0.25% if you get it on the money market, or even just paying your own depositor, which would be the county itself, like a 0.5%. Anyway, so this is just one more development in that whole possibility of setting up a bank and getting some properties in there as well, which you get for free, and then you can fix them up, and you can use the credit from your own bank to fix them up. Now, I did, you know, I just posted that article, and it was in Huffington Post and among other places, and I got a lot of grief on the Huffington Post one that, you know, there were some lawyers that have been practicing in California for a long time and pointed out all the things that we're going to be up against if we try it, but still, anyway, that's the current status of that plan.
So it's a good ruling that happened in Washington State, Ellen, and now the issue is what happens in Washington and what happens across the country.
Yeah, well, now Oregon has a similar bill or a similar case pending. If they rule the same way, it would be lovely if California would rule that way. The last case that we have that came close, this is a Washington Supreme Court case. So there are very few cases that have made it to the Supreme Court in any state on that issue.
Is Bain in this case, Bain versus MERS, is that Romney's Bain?
No, it's a woman named Bain, a single woman.
A woman named Bain.
Just coincidence.
Bain was the company Romney was with for so many years, and he still is very much, very much on the payroll to the tune of something like maybe $20 million in income every single year. I wrote about Romney. It's been a number of months now. I mean, the guy isn't even working there. I guess he's a sort of sub rosa consultant. I don't know what he does for him, but if you get paid $20 million, Ellen, you better be doing something for that kind of money.
Yeah, well, and this whole idea of vulture capitalism—it's not leverage buyouts, which wasn't that his business. It's horrible. That's what's wrong with this country, and we're about considering electing a president whose business is...
Oh, absolutely. Vulture capitalism, Ellen. I think that describes it best.
Companies and spitting them out after you take all the assets.
Oh, that's exactly right. You know, fire all the people, strip mine the assets, mm-hmm. take a company, break it up into pieces, make it completely unlike the way it was before. And if you're lucky, you win 2 out of 3 times or something, and you make a lot of money. And that's what the business of Romney was in. I mean, literally destroying things to make money. Mm-hmm. Financial war, Ellen, as opposed to a military war.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't Obama's business, but, you know, Obama is a constitutional lawyer, taught at the University of Chicago. Makes no difference. I mean, he totally ignores the law. He violates it every day. U.S. law, constitutional law, statute law, international law. I mean, just the fact that the guy knows the Constitution and teaches it. I don't know what the hell he taught his students at the University of Chicago. I don't know. Maybe he actually taught it right, but he doesn't practice it any other way. So I don't know. I guess you could be the opposite, Ellen, which doesn't usually turn out to be the case. You can be a sinner in business, go into government, and change your spots and become a saint. Well, now wouldn't that be extraordinary? That would be a Ripley, believe it or not. If anybody remembers Ripley.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the whole idea that you have to be wealthy to get elected is there's something definitely wrong with our system. But that's why we're aiming for the local level, trying to do something locally.
Well, back in the 1970s, I believe it was, maybe even going back to the 60s when the Democrats ran things, the Republican strategy, besides Nixon's Southern strategy and so on, but the Republican strategy was begin winning over the country at the grassroots. You know, go to the school boards, go to the city councils, go to the mayoral races, do things like that, and then work your way up the food chain. And they had other things, too. You know, they get the corporate think tanks and foundations to fund them. I mean, they had a whole lot of stuff going for them. And you get a lot of money behind you, and then you start building a system. You know, I mean, you plant a tree. I mean, it grows from the ground up. It doesn't sprout full-blown. So, I mean, that was their strategy, and it worked very well. Unfortunately, the Democrats, instead of being an opposition party, it was to some degree years ago, certainly was with Roosevelt and Republicans, although Roosevelt was a patrician, certainly not the kind of Democrat that I would prefer, but he did the right things because it turned out to be important to do. Harry Truman, even Lyndon Johnson, who was so horrible in so many ways, my God, he gave us Medicare. I mean, I'm very indebted to Lyndon Johnson. I hate him for what he did overseas, the wars and the rest of it, but we got civil rights under Lyndon Johnson. We got Medicare, vital for me, vital for so many people. And so, I mean, give the guy credit where credit is deserved. There's nobody around like that today. Doesn't matter, a Democrat, Republican, they're all the same. Obama wants to destroy these things just the way the Republicans do. So I don't know what the difference between
Romney.
Well, and
Lyndon Johnson had a way of working everybody, right?
Oh, he sure did.
Like
he was
backroom deals type things.
He was bigger than life. He used to like to get right up nose to nose with somebody. He was a big, tall, muscular, but big and tall, and broad. I think well over 200 pounds. He used to like to stick his nose in somebody's face and just cower them with his presence. I remember reading a couple of comments about people who would meet with him in the Oval Office and literally having a terrifying experience being confronted with Lyndon Johnson's power. But that power dissipated very fast after he turned tail in Vietnam because the protests finally got the war to end and the Congress to turn against it. And it literally destroyed him and ended his life early, so you can be bigger than life. And you can end up with a shorter one than you should have had. And he literally, I mean, he literally was the power. And he was a former majority leader in the Congress. And his close mentor and ally was Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House. Between the two of them, my God, that was a Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig of the Congress. And he transformed it into the presidency. Whether he had a hand in killing JFK, I have no idea. Maybe he did. But he took over, and bad policies bring bad results. He lasted so many years. I just hope the bad policies will bring bad results now, and the people running things will go, and others will take their place, and I just wonder how much worse it can be. But we better change, Ellen. I'll let you continue. Yeah, MERS is very important, and all the rest that you're writing about. This new article that you're writing about, Global, do you have a title for it?
No, the one on MERS.
The one on global banking, public banking.
Oh, that was a book. That's a book that I'm almost done
with. Oh, that's your book. Well, I know about your book. You're getting close to
publishing
date? I know
the book. I said it was going to be done a year ago. But it's so slow. You know, I have a certain reputation to preserve, and I don't want to lower my standards.
Oh, absolutely not.
You know, you got to check all your footnotes and got to be right about everything. It's difficult. And be discursive, cover everything.
Well, Ellen, you know I am dying to talk about that book on this program. I don't want to ask you for a publishing date because, those are fluid. And
I've got all the material there. I'm so close. But anyway.
Oh, you'll cue me. You put the word out and cue me when it's going to be published. You got to get me a copy, and then we got to spend not one program on it. We got to spend a number of programs on it because this is the big stuff. This is the ticket to change the system to make it work for everybody. And we're both acolytes for this, Ellen. I mean, it really works. You proved it in Web of Debt that historically, whenever this is tried, it works. It works. It doesn't fail. Mm-hmm. It can work again.
I'm very impressed myself. I mean, this is material I didn't know till I was researching it, but there are many excellent models around the world. You know, Venezuela recently, they have a woman president, of course.
Not a woman president.
Argentina has
Argentina.
A woman president and a woman head of the central bank. And so between them, they've decided they're just not going to. I mean, it's the things that they're flaunting the BIS, basically the type of thing that I had argued earlier that Libya wound up in a war for, or a rebellion that Gaddafi got taken down for. So they're doing the same thing, but very discreetly. You know, they're not talking about it so much, but they're just doing it, which is that they're using the central bank to issue the money to fund the things that the country needs.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Fund productivity. Yeah.
I didn't know that about Argentina. Malaysia has that system, right?
Yeah, they don't talk about it either. Well, they did under
Mahathir.
Yeah, and now I mean he's concerned himself about the direction the government's going. So I'm not sure what they're doing right now. I think they're backtracking on that.
But there were more countries than people would think that do an awful lot of public
Banking. And the ones that you don't even know what China is doing. We don't see their books, but it's pretty. To me, that's pretty obviously what they're doing. They're just printing the money, using it for what they need done, and they do it through their big government-owned development bank. And they have the four big banks actually. Japan does it, and they do it discreetly. They call it debt, and they just say they have this mountain of debt. But of course, the debt's never going to get paid off because it's a debt to themselves. So it's the same as printing money, and they use that money. It turns out that Japan, which has the highest debt-to-GDP ratio in the world, is also the world's biggest creditor. I mean, how is that possible? How can they be doing so well when they're doing so poorly? It's because they're not really in debt. They're in debt to themselves, and so it's just an accounting entry thing. They're in debt to their post bank and to a lot of other, to the Bank of Japan itself. It's a debt at a low interest that they're paying to themselves, basically.
The countries that get in trouble, Ellen, are the ones who get indebted to other countries.
Yeah.
If you own the regional or global loan shark, whether it be America or the IMF or whatever, then you are in very serious trouble. But if you're in hock to yourself, then one hand washes out the other one. The right hand is the debtor, the left hand is the creditor. You can keep this game going a long time and do very nicely for yourself. And that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
We got a couple of minutes left. Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Well, I'll just mention about that post bank idea. There are four unions. The post office has four unions, and one of them has submitted a resolution, and the others were considering it to actually start a postal bank, which is something they did before. They had a postal bank from 1911 to 1967, which is very successful. And the thing about a postal bank, you've got all these unbanked people, like one in four families is either unbanked or underbanked. And you know what they do with their money. First of all, their money is under the mattress. So like in Japan, where they pull it out and they put it in the postal bank, then they can use that money. You know, it's the people's money. It's in the bank, and it's still there. But the bank can then take all that money that they have as deposits, and they can buy bonds with it, government bonds. So it's good to get the unbanked people's money out and into a public bank. But besides that, it's very good for the unbanked because they're paying. Those are the ones that are paying like $800 for every $300 loan, you know, for payday loans, and they have to pay for every single check, or they're doing money orders or whatever. So if they had it, they don't even have checking accounts, so they can't write checks to people. So it's cover a lot of needs.
And you say it, you say it, and I say it, Ellen. Doing it right isn't rocket science. It's mostly common sense. And in the meantime, if people are upset in the other 49 states, they can move to North Dakota and have a public banking system. Pack your bags, move to North Dakota, lots of wide open spaces. And you can bank with a real bank. Ellen, many, many thanks.
Thank you, too.
I'm off and running downtown to do my other thing.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I look forward to both. Then I'll come back and finish my second article I want to get out tomorrow. Thank you, Ellen. I'll shoot you a fast email, then I'm off and running. And join us, of course, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.